Blog Talk Radio.
Love and happiness, yeah, something that can make you do wrong, make you do right, yeah. Love.
Not in this century, not going forward for our children or our society.
So LEAP, like myself, I'm a former homicide detective. I joined LEAP because before joining LEAP, I had a voice in this where I was denouncing what I saw was racism, intentional discrimination in the drug laws that were targeting minority citizens while exonerating white citizens for committing the same crimes. That in itself violates the 14th Amendment, which says that every person has an equal protection under the law. So when you look at, since the drug war began in 1970, 1 in 3 black men having been incarcerated and similarly situated white men having been exonerated, that is not equal. That is an injustice, and it violates the Constitution.
Yes, that, and being a homicide investigator, retired now, I think drugs, killing people, big farmers' money off of, but a lot of drugs, but marijuana has never killed anybody.
Well, I don't think people should think about it that way. It's not just about marijuana, it's about every drug, because prior to 1970, prior to Nixon enacting the war on drugs, and law enforcement went from 200,000 armed citizens that were sworn to protect and serve all equally, that ballooned to 800,000 to present day. And the war on drugs itself, if we think about prior to 1970, we didn't have drive-by shootings at the lower end of the spectrum. The war on drugs is responsible for the violence, the gun violence that happens downstream of the policy, simply because when you think about the enactment of the policy, it created it fueled risk. People then could take a risk for profit. Across the border, you have $65 billion that's been smuggled every year for drugs because there's a supply and demand, but that's because also people are willing to take a risk to not just smuggle, but also sell the drugs downstream in impoverished neighborhoods. The other problem, of course, is if you're going to carry a supply that's worth, some sort of money, you run the risk of your supply being robbed. So now you're going to go and arm yourself with a gun. And these policies since 1970 are responsible for all of the violence downstream. That doesn't mean that I advocate people using drugs. I by no means want to see women, children, men using drugs. What I'm trying to say is that we spent $1.5 trillion trying to keep people prohibited from using drugs, and how has that worked out for us today after 50 years with $1.5 trillion spent on locking up people trying to prohibit drug use? It isn't working. And at the same time, the Daily News just this week reported the Nixon administration was definitely trying to target black people. People have already known, because we're the people that have been locked up more than any other group. The Nixon administration targeted black people in these policies because the 1964 Civil Rights Act created equality in the workplace, and one way to control black people and make it so that they can't be equal in the workplace is by giving them a mass incarceration record, and then you have to check the box for the rest of your life. So these are things that I hope that we can discuss today, which are the realities.
And that's the very, is this all, prohibition was all like part of a greater plan to keep black people not only enslaved, but financially enslaved and politically enslaved, because the only people who benefit, the people who benefit the most from prohibition are the organized crime barons. That's making up $50 billion. Those are the people who are benefiting the most overall in the world. But as you were saying, this is part of a strategy that is a racial strategy toward minorities and African Americans in particular.
Well, let me just say this, though, because I want to make sure that we're understanding what I'm saying. This policy, when it was enacted in 1970, it just amounted to a jobs bill. If you have people who are hired to go out, corral black people, but they're exonerating similarly situated white people who commit similar offenses, criminal acts, that in itself shows the discriminatory nature behind the policy. The policy created jobs for a majority of white people in the criminal justice field, law enforcement, mass incarceration because you had to build prisons. So I don't want people to focus so much necessarily on the drug end of this, where there's a for-profit by the drug people who are smuggling drugs in, because they themselves are a very small percentile of what this policy was meant to do. Slavery itself, if you think about slavery, it impacted 100% of black people, but it enriched 100% of white people. And you have to go and think about this as just a jobs bill. And it targeted certain groups of people and exonerated others, and that violates the Constitution.
I understand that. And like we're seeing in Alabama, we have to incarcerate people for minor offenses, being jailed, losing their rights, they're getting out, they're not getting their job, housing. Again, so kind of drug offenses that destroying that's completed. I mean, what else do you use do you have as an American if you no longer the political get a job to feed yourself and you can't? This is what's driving the prison rate. It's 4 times likely as a black person to be arrested than a white person on a, and the numbers just don't bear out the constitutionality and the right of it. It's just not bearing out.
I mean, we have a bad connection, but I'm going to try to answer what I heard. When we're talking about the outcomes of what are now very prevalent, we have evidence because there's data now to support that the fact that the policy is discriminatory. We also have admissions from a federal government administrators that are saying that the policy is discriminatory, intentionally discriminatory. The issue around the country becomes, you know, in terms of, trying to make sure that we going forward address the longstanding problem by making sure that constitutionally we are familiar with what the Constitution says. There are a lot of people, unfortunately, that aren't familiar with that. And, you know, having a radio program like yourself, like what you have now, is important for us to share, you know, information of empowerment while we also educate and teach ourselves what that means. Because there are too many people walking around that are misinformed, and when you're misinformed or you have a poor network, you can't get the right information, you can't protect yourself, and then that means that you're more easily controlled because you're willing to fall for, foolishness instead of understanding how to go and combat that foolishness.
People, in each locality, I know you.
You might have to call me back, Marcus, because we have a bad connection. You want me to call back?
I can hear you just fine. You might like to tell me more about the organization.
Yeah, I'm catching you all broken up though.
Okay, just you can hang up and call right back.
I think we have a better connection now. Go for it. I'm sorry.
Okay, now I was just saying, tell people how they can help your organization or help themselves locally to get organized. What they can do to make this change, and how they can also reach you via Twitter, Facebook, and all your other connections. Give them a way where they can contact you and give some type of support.
Okay, great. People can look at the LEAP website. They can go to www.leap.cc, and on the website, you can see what LEAP is about. You can explore the website for the Speakers Bureau. In some instances, we go to state governments and we actually assist citizens with testimony. If we support their efforts, we assist them with testimony, live testimony and written testimony, to help petition you know, are elected to change laws. Because, you know, if we make a demand, but we make a demand to ourselves, that's not empowerment. Empowerment means that we have to actually legislate laws to be changed, and that means that we have to be in contact with our, you know, local elected officials as well as federal government officials to do that. So, you know, the drug laws, as they are written today, you know, I want other, you know, people to also consider that there's disparity in terms of zero tolerance enforcement. I mean, when crack cocaine was at the high epidemic, there was a zero tolerance enforcement against black people who were afflicted. There were 90% of black people afflicted by crack cocaine. Since 2003, opiate addiction is at a, you know, 90% white afflicted rate, same as the crack cocaine epidemic. But yet and still, now we're entering a more kinder, friendlier enforcement of people who are afflicted with a mental health disorder. And, you know, that in itself should be something that people should look at, because, you know, we shouldn't have this disparity simply because white people become afflicted by an epidemic that black people were afflicted by. And we need to go and make sure that lawmakers accept that we are now making demands to fix this, because you can't have it where you're targeting one group of people, but you're exonerating the other group. That is not equal justice, violates the 14th Amendment, and it's got to be fixed. But we have to go and collectively demand these things get fixed. If we're relying on other people to voice the concern, do the hard work, shame on us.
Yes, and it's not going to happen.
That's right.
And as you said that, that made me think about this current presidential election we got now, when exactly what you said, now that this epidemic has hit white America, it's a big focus now.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if we're in a presidential election cycle right now, mass incarceration, the disparity rate, fixing the problem based on government policy which targets one group, exonerates another group, these should be front burner topics. Because, you know, if we think about, you know, aside from the arrest, if we think about the negative impact on black men, if one in three black men are incarcerated, that means that while they're now incarcerated, if they have a family, they have children, the children are fatherless, the wife or the spouse or the girlfriend, she's now going to be placed in a position without, you know, another income coming in. So she's now most likely going to be further impoverished. And at the same time, the person who's in, you know, in custody for a low-level offense, if it's a nonviolent low-level offense, they're not able to go and make any money. So we're talking about a cycle of poverty. And, you know, when we look at the black community and we think about one in three black men being locked up, if the white community had one in three white males locked up, they would be equally as impoverished as the black community. So this is the reason why these discussions are very important, because, you know, until we talk about the real reality of the problem, we can't get to the bottom of how to solve it.
And that is true. And as you said, once they incarcerated, there's also damage to the child. Any children, their self-esteem is going to be damaged in all this. It's a huge effect upon the family and the whole African-American community when this happens.
That's
like
right.
You said, it creates a cycle of poverty. If you can't get a job, you can't get housing, and you can't vote no more, I mean, sometimes that's making you ineligible for a mate. You know, it's going to be hard for you to find a mate or to maintain that relationship. You go to jail for 5 years for a minor drug offense, it's going to be hard to maintain that relationship with a significant other while you're locked up. That's going to be a whole lot of stress, families having to travel long distances just to keep the relationship going. It just does so much damage that the war on drugs is not working. The war on drugs has failed. We've lost. There's time for a new action to be taken.
Well, I want to take that a step further, because slavery was about, you know, breaking up family units that were black and demasculating the black male by doing all types of things. They would rape black women. They would rape children. They would sell people off. And, you know, that was a form of control, as well as, you know, if anyone tried to form a, you know, insurrection towards, you know, this human rights violation, you'd get killed. So, you know, I want everyone to consider that history repeats itself. Yes, you know, we're no longer looking at, you know, prior to 1865, where, you know, the country, the federal government stepped in and said that after the Civil War, slavery was abolished. I mean, in 1783, a man by the name of Quoc Walker in Massachusetts, 1783, 100 years before Civil War, was the first black man ever to sue a white man. Quoc Walker versus Jennison is the case. And he won his freedom, and he abolished slavery in Massachusetts 100 years before the Civil War. So, you know, it's important that people realize their history is power, because if one man, one act, one court case could abolish slavery in the state of Massachusetts, and then that was the trigger for the chain reaction of events that abolished slavery in every other jurisdiction in this country, that means that we have equal power to white people. We just have to exercise it.
Yeah. Tell me your take on some of the countries who have ended the prohibition on drug use, and most of them seem to have their crime rate go down.
Well, the thing about it is this. When you think about drug policy and the prohibition of drug policy, I want people to think about the 1920s when alcohol prohibition in this country rang true for over a decade, and Al Capone and other mafia-type men were born into this world because of the prohibition. They were killing white people. White people were killing white people. White people were shooting up establishments because the policy created downstream violence, because people were trying to make money off of the prohibition. The same is true when you have drug prohibition. It fuels the violence downstream. Now, in other countries, because they consider this to be a mental health disorder, what happens is they treat it as a medical condition. You know, you go to see your doctor. You say, hey, doctor, you know what? I'm addicted to something. And your doctor, in the privacy of the care of the medical doctor's office, starts to treat you for your affliction. And what happens is the pharmaceutical companies step in. And in those countries where these things are regulated, manufactured, let's say heroin or cocaine or whatever it might be, marijuana, these things are manufactured and regulated by the pharmaceutical company, because now you don't have to worry about being maybe a heroin addict over in England, sticking a needle in your arm, and then all of a sudden you die because someone manufactured street corner heroin that might have been cut with rat poison. You don't know how that stuff was made. So in other countries, they've stepped up to realize that sometimes, and I'm going to use heroin specifically, in order to treat heroin, there's been clinical trial studies that have revealed the only remedy to go and solve heroin addiction for those who don't respond well to oral methadone alone is to give them heroin with oral methadone. And in these countries, because they've done clinical trials, they've shown with these people who were heroin addicts that might have been out trying to commit crimes because they're chasing after their addiction all day long, committing crimes to get money. They now found, because they receive an oral methadone and a heroin fix from their doctors in the privacy of the medical doctor's office, they actually go back to work. They're functioning. Are they functioning 100%?
Yeah.
No. They're not functioning 100%, but at least they have lives.
And instead of putting a burden on the taxpayer of just jailing them, putting them in jail, feeding the prison industrial complex, you get these people back into society to the best of their ability until you get them totally weaned off of it. And I would imagine also, too, where it's regulated, you're going to see less instances of these diseases just spread by these bad needles. It's regulated and overseen by doctors that can have them with clean needles, so these different diseases won't get spread around as bad, too. I can imagine also a benefit of that, too, less disease spreading by needles, sharing needles.
Well, I mean, like I said before, if you have $1.5 trillion spent on this thing since 1970, think about if that money had been reallocated towards education, had been reallocated towards upliftment in communities to go and make sure that, you know, we resolved poor education in certain school districts versus, you know, good education being received by students in other districts. If we had resolved that issue, the chances are pretty good that the number of people having this health, this mental health issue would have been lowered, because who wants to be a drug addict? You know what I mean? That's not someone's mission in life, that they wake up one morning and say, you know, being a drug addict is the great thing that they want to become. So, you know, I want people to realize, again, I'm not advocating drug use. I'm not about people going out and, you know, trying to go and use drugs. But at the same time, we have a reality. 1.5% of the population are hardcore drug users. And that 1.5% who are hardcore cannot kick their habit. So, you know, and that's not talking about the whole spectrum of people who are using drugs. I'm talking about the hardcore. And, you know, for that hardcore, are we a nation that we're saying that it's better to put someone away for $50,000 a year, or are we going to look at trying to go and put that person back into mainstream, let them get a job, let them pay some taxes, and help them so that they can help support, you know, paying their medical doctor, you know, the medical doctor's bills and stuff like that, and let them receive their treatment. We don't lock diabetic people up, do we? So, I mean, you know, and a diabetic patient can go into a coma, can cause a car accident, can kill somebody and all that stuff. So, you know, law enforcement shouldn't be policing something that, you know, should be tended to by the care of a physician and the privacy of a physician. And if someone violates the law and commits a crime, then so be it. That's where law enforcement steps back in. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. I had an inbox question somebody wanted to make sure that I ask you, and that was to ask you, how do you feel about the asset forfeiture law?
Right. I mean, asset forfeiture, of course, is another issue, another area that is of great disparity because, you know, when you have racial profiling and ticketing of minorities, that does not happen for white citizens. If this was an equal opportunity enforcement, then it would have self-corrected itself. But, you know, the issue, of course, is that minorities are targeted for ticketing more than white people. That's the reality. If we look at Ferguson, and the DOJ just recently released a report that out of the citizens in Ferguson, a majority of the people living in Ferguson are basically in a police-controlled city, town, that the majority have outstanding warrants for traffic violations. That right there in itself should alarm everybody. But more importantly, it should alarm black people because, you know, this thing about equal justice, equal opportunity, in trying to make sure that we straighten out injustices, clearly Ferguson is an area, and there are many other cities and towns across the country that have been negatively impacted by law enforcement, but clearly that's a system that was out of control that targeted one group while exonerating another group. And that right there, and again, goes to the fact that asset forfeiture, if you're targeting people for their cars, for their homes, for their businesses, and you're taking them from being able to have a livelihood, but you're targeting them and you're taking money out of their pocket, and now they can't survive, you're actually trying to go in, I believe, in many instances, put them in the position of having to commit a crime, you know, while you target them unjustly.
Yeah. Okay, you want to say anything else in closing? I'd love to have you back, and I would love for this to be a weekly thing we could do, is to have you guys on and speak about what it is you're doing and to keep our listeners updated, because we have some serious problems here in Alabama. It's nationwide and worldwide, but in Alabama it's very serious because we're incarcerating so many people for minor drug offenses that the federal government is threatening to take over the prisons. They're now just announced they're going to build 4 super prisons here in Alabama. So you just want to wrap this up, and hopefully we can get you back again. Anything you want to say about law enforcement against prohibition?
Certainly. Let's start with what you just mentioned. I mean, if people have a civil rights violation, if they find that someone is abusing their trust, if someone is not protecting and serving you under the color of law, one of the things that people need to realize is you must file a complaint, whether it's with local officials or federal authorities. You can file a complaint with the FBI if you need to. You can file a complaint with the Department of Justice on their website if you need to. People need to find the time, and they need to make the effort to report anybody in law enforcement that is violating the Constitution and not protecting and serving you properly. You need to go and take it upon yourself to file a complaint, because without data of a complaint, it never happened. Without a person filing a complaint and signing their name, most law enforcement agencies don't take anonymous complaints as being real complaints. So they're going to dump those things in the trash too. You got to be courageous and stand up and start realizing that every person has a God-given talent and has the ability to go and represent themselves, but you got to stand up and do that. So that's what I want to say about that. In terms of LEAP,
okay.
I mean, you know, have us on anytime. You know, reach out to me anytime you want. I can certainly help you out with that, and let's make that happen.
Definitely, definitely. Like I said, I would love nothing more than to give you guys a spot on this network, because coming next month on the 6th, our shows are going to be 2 hours long, so we'll be able to do a lot more. And I appreciate you guys for standing up. Appreciate you, and look forward to having you back on again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.